Welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast. Success isn't a goal, it's a journey. I interview the most incredible humans to keep your mind optimized for growth. Hello and welcome to an episode of the Growth Mindset Podcast with your host Sam Harris, and my guest today is Nick Telson, who is a serial angel investor and previously co-founded Design My Night in 2010. Yeah, I'm really happy to now have you on the show.
Delighted to be here.
So you then went into like marketing for a while. So do you feel like you actually learned a lot of useful skills that you then translated into Design My Night? Because certainly you clearly learned a lot about culture beforehand, which I figure must have been really useful.
But I think a good thing about language degree and going abroad is understanding people rather than culture. So I think just getting to know different types of people and what makes people tick, I think is A, very interesting, but then B, very useful for marketing. And then what we did at Design My Night. So that was the main thing I took from probably like studies and year abroad into Design My Night. L'Oreal is a bit of a different beast. It's monstrously big. I don't think people realize how big L'Oreal is and how many brands it owns. It is a corporate giant. It's also a French company, which sounds silly, but the French have very distinct ways of doing business. And my bosses were French and we went out to Paris a lot to present to those French bosses. And they're very sort of no-nonsense, direct type of people, whereas our British, we're a lot more go round the subject rather than hit the nail. So there's a lot of learning about that different type of culture. But I think L'Oreal, for me, it was learning to launch products, was managing a P&L, taking charge of a business. They do give you a lot of autonomy at L'Oreal. So very quickly, you're in charge of small business units. I was fortunate enough to climb the ladder and be a marketing manager. So you're looking after brands doing 30, 40, 50 million pound revenue, and you're in charge of that P&L and presenting to people like Sainsbury's and then also your sales reps. So there's confidence that you're building in how to present an idea, how to present a new product as well. So all of that packaged together made a really good starting point to then go and start my own business.
Yeah, that actually sounds pretty ideal, to be fair. Nice. Yeah, I wouldn't mind of just being paid well to have learned all those things over the past sort of 10 years as opposed to just doing startups the entire time.
I mean, it was hard work. Don't get me wrong. Like L'Oreal, they worked you to the bone and you're not on the best salary there. Marketing is not always at peak salaries. We would work late nights. We would work weekends. You take your laptop home, old school, and work. So you learn a lot, but you also learn work ethic as well. And that's not necessarily the right work ethic, but I learned to work very, very hard there.
Yeah, cool. So why did you then leave L'Oreal? Was it just the idea, or is it that you wanted to have the freedom to do your own things?
My co-founder, Andrew's my best friend from uni. We met in sort of the first year. And we'd always discussed doing our own thing. He worked at Accenture, so even more corporate-y. And I think deep down, we both always just wanted to try our own thing. I can't put my finger on what it was, potentially the freedom. But I think just climbing the ladder nonstop till you're 60 didn't really appeal to us. And ironically, in big companies, the higher you go, the less you actually do. I would look at what my GM was doing at L'Oreal, who's the next step above me. And she was actually just doing reports all day and reporting into Paris on the numbers. And actually, as a marketeer or a creative, that's the bit you like least. So I think we both had in our heads, yes, we could stay at our companies, earn very good salaries, climb up to the top, but it wouldn't have been very fulfilling. We weren't actively thinking of ideas. We stumbled across the idea of Design My Night. And then that's when we validated the idea. And then we thought, okay, well, let's give it a go. We did work at our corporates for a year while setting up Design My Night. So it wasn't a quick jump from one to the other.
That's often the way from people in that sort of side of things and working things out. But it was like the very first actual business thing you'd ever tried then. You didn't do any kind of like small side hustles as a younger person then.
That was the first sort of proper go it alone. I'd always done bits and bobs, but this was the first sort of proper business we thought, let's give it a go.
So did you have other ideas that you sort of tested like a little bit and then decided to like kill? Or is that like literally the first one that you're like, okay, this could be a good idea, and then started like putting any kind of work into it?
We had a few very small seeds of other ideas that we didn't even really dig on. And then the idea for Design My Night came up. which became a very different business from our original idea. And that was the first one that we thought, let's proper dig on this. Again, I think naivety, what we know now and how we dig on business opportunities now versus what we did back then was very different. I wonder if when we came up with the idea and we dug on it like we do now on businesses, we actually would have gone ahead. I don't know. So there's definitely a bit of naivety. I think we were just both passionate to do it. And we both knew that if it failed, we could go back to our jobs. So I left L'Oréal on very good terms, same with him. So it was more of a mentality of let's just give it a go, see what happens. And the worst happens, it fails, we'll just go back to our jobs.
Makes it easy to not be too worried. But even if you don't have a job to go back to, and you'll have learned something, you'll have more skills. So maybe you could take a new job in startups and like lots of other things that you'd never have even thought of could happen. So you can limit yourselves by being too worried about things.
People message me now, not necessarily about starting a company, but as you say, actually just getting into the world, especially now for people who might have not been to uni or fresh out of uni, the generic I'm going to get into the startup world is actually an opportunity now, which it didn't feel like it was back in 2010. And there's so many different disciplines working for a startup now, from account management and customer success, where you don't even necessarily need direct qualifications. That's what I say to people is, well, just go and start a career in the startup world, see what it's like, learn. Your first foray into startups doesn't have to be your own company.
Yeah, definitely. So it certainly makes it a bit easier when someone else has more of the stress. Very good. So could you try and like unpack what the original idea was and like the process you went through over that year before you then like quit your jobs to sort of validate it and then work out what it was you were doing? And
so, yeah, in a nutshell, the actual idea was a B2C website, which sounds silly now, but very sort of mobile digital forward for discovering nightlife, primarily at the start in London. I'm from London, so I knew the sort of landscape. And back in that day, you had Time Out, who could never really nail digital, and some might say still haven't. And then you had a few other big listing discovery platforms that were just very, very bad online experiences and, you know, have since folded. So we just wanted to be a very user-friendly nightlife discovery platform, basically. Very simple. The original idea was actually based on drinks deals. So we wanted to focus on where you can go and get a drinks deal, get lots of users, and then sell advertising to the likes of Diageo. So that was like the first idea. And it was called like Drinkonomical before it was called Design My Night.
So economical drinking?
Exactly. So drinks deals, Drinkonomical, created a word. But actually, fortunately enough, I spoke to a friend of mine who worked at Diageo, and she said no drinks brand will ever advertise on a site that's just promoting cheap drinking. So that was sort of the first blow and the whole business plan out of the window. So we sort of went back to the drawing board again. Still liked the idea of the scope of nightlife. So then we actually came up with the idea of, at that time, you had Go Compare and Compare the Market and all of those coming out. So could we do like a price comparison site for nightlife? So the main search function would be select your budget, select where you want to go out, and then we would show you where to go based on budget. So that's how we did like an early pivot before we even really started, from a drinks deal site to a going out price comparison site. And then that became our USP. We were like the first price comparison site for going out. And that's how we launched Design My Night. How did we validate it? So doing lots of surveys of friends of friends of friends of friends. So we had like a Survey Monkey and just sent it out. Would you use it? What type of things would you be looking for? What do you currently use? What don't you like about what you currently use? We also spent every weekend going into bars and pubs, just asking to speak to the manager, asking what platforms they advertise on. Are they good? What would you like to see different? Got tons of feedback. And basically all of that told us that what was out there wasn't good enough. So that sort of gave us the confidence to then actually commit to it and go and build Design My Night. I say a year because then we had an agency that was working with us on the site, and that took probably about 6 months because we could only work on it in the evenings and the weekends when we weren't going into bars and pubs. So we went at quite a slow pace to actually just build the website, and because neither of us have any tech knowledge, so obviously that slows everything down. After that year, we had the site that we put live. got some early traction, and that allowed us to sort of leave our jobs and go for it.
Cool. How worried were you about like competitors? Because obviously like now there's like Airbnb experiences and sort of other few things. As in, was it something that you kind of felt like, oh, if you don't do this now, we'll miss the opportunity? Or was it more just like interest, this would be cool to do?
I don't think we thought we'd miss the opportunity. I think it was what was out then, which is 10 years ago, was very poor. So you had some really big competitors, but they just weren't doing it very well. So we knew that was the opportunity, that not to be scared of them, that we could actually just do it better. And so it proved. And silly things like really focusing on SEO. And what we did know was using the Google keyword search tool was that there were millions of people every month Googling where to go out in the UK with all its different parameters, rooftop bars, basement bars, secret bars, best pubs, gastro pubs. So that shows you you've got this captive market. And at the moment, they're all going to these subpar websites. So it was less worried about missing out on the opportunity and more, we've got this opportunity. We can disrupt what the people are doing. Let's do it better. And then over the 10 years, lots of competitors came along, but came and went, most of them, because they didn't really have solid business plans, which we could see. You can't survive just being a discovery platform. Our pivot to software was sort of our golden ticket. So we saw all of these cooler websites come along over the 10 years, make a bit of a splash and then disappear. Once we'd embedded ourselves, we were pretty confident that we could become the leaders.
At what point did you then go to investors then? So you had like a bit of traction, as in you sort of launched a website and had some friends using it. Did you then kind of grow it for a few years, like self-funded, or did you go straight to like angels?
We grew it for about 20 months, self-funded. So we had interns and it was just us two doing everything. And we had an agency in India that was doing the dev work for us. So yeah, we grew that. Focused on just making really good, useful changes to the website, speaking to users constantly. During that time, we also stumbled upon the booking model. So actually making a booking from our website into bars and pubs and restaurants. We were doing that all manually. So it would be like make a booking on our website. It would come into Andrew and I. We would be phoning up the bars and pubs and booking people in 18 hours a day. Obviously, most bars are only open in the evening anyway to book people in. So we did that for 18 months. And then it was actually our mentor, who happened to also be the head of entrepreneurship at London Business School, who said, I think you guys should look into funding. He helped us put a plan together. And actually, when he saw the finished plan and what our vision was, he wanted to invest himself. And then he said, I know six other angels that I'm going to introduce you to that we've all sort of invested together. If you impress them all, I think we can close the round just as this group. So we went round, met them all individually, presented the idea. It's disgusting when you look back what we presented and how we presented it. I think it was literally a printed out PDF, old school, which it was back then. They all said yes, luckily. And it was a very tough, we were running out of our own personal cash. And it was probably 3 weeks. If they wouldn't have invested, we would have had to have closed it. But we got that call from the final angel saying, yes, I'm in too. So the whole group was in. So we had our first round of funding, which was 250 grand. And that allowed us to actually kick on. Again, it was a bit different back then. Like I think now companies, their first instinct is to raise money straight away. Like that's the first step of success on the whole ladder of success. But angel investing and all of that wasn't as big back in like 2010, 2011. I think it's a lot more of an industry almost now. So yeah, it was more spit and sawdust, just working our ass off, draining our bank accounts, using credit cards till we got that first round.
Cool. That's a pretty motivating, scary story. Nice. And I mean, it's sort of what all investors want you to have done in terms of sort of showing that you've got like skin in the game and spent time constantly speaking to users and manually doing things as much as possible and seeing that people really want it. So I guess you did have a really good business case, despite it being in like a not ideal PDF printout.
What they always said to us, and actually on when we exited, we went for dinner, and what they actually said to us was, what we could see from you guys is you knew the industry inside out. You'd been in it for 2 years. You were speaking to owners of pubs and bars and restaurants. You were speaking to your users, your customers on the website. So while the original business plan that we presented to them, they weren't supremely confident about, they knew that A, we were the right founders to have the graft to do it, but also that we just knew the casual hospitality industry so well that we would stumble upon something that would become our exit, which is precisely what happened. So they were sort of backing us rather than the business at that time.
That's really interesting. Thanks. Certainly on Techstars, they expect like half the companies to actually have a pivot during the program, but they just like invest in team and show that you kind of at least know the market and you've got the passion for it, and rather than necessarily the idea completely.
It's a fine balance. You don't want to be someone chasing bits of paper in the wind constantly as a founder, going after idea after idea after idea, but you've got to have self-awareness that there might be better opportunities.
So what did you have to like learn over the next few years, and sort of how did you change the business?
So for us, our big pivot was from, let's call it media company, B2C website, to software. So again, from speaking to our close bar restaurant pub partners, when we were putting bookings manually into these places, we would often hear gripes from them about the software they used. So the ones people will probably know, OpenTable, BookaTable, etc. So these restaurant booking softwares, there's a lot. They're the two big boys, but I could list you 10 to 15 of booking software just in the restaurant industry. And they were just constantly griping about it. Andrew and I were like, oh, okay. Like we did with the B2C side, maybe there's some disruption we could do here, even though they're big boys we'll be up against. And it was actually one of our bar partners called Dirty Martini, who are bigger now. So I think they've got about 15 bars across the UK. Their marketing manager, we were very close with. She actually said to us, I think you should look in the bar industry for a booking software. She said, we all use restaurant booking software in our bars, but they're just not fit for purpose, because a bar, you need a lot more flexibility than a restaurant. You know, a restaurant is a table of two, a table of four, a table of six, whereas a bar is couches and sofas and a table that can stand 10 and seat four and all of that stuff. And you're constantly moving your bar around as well. So we thought, oh, okay, well, that's interesting. It could be a niche within the booking software market. So that's what we went after. And we worked probably for about 8 months with a couple of partners. So a bar group, a pub group, a restaurant group. And we actually said to them, if you were to build a booking software from scratch, what would you want in it? And they all gave us back scope documents. We had our own ideas too. From all of those, we built our booking software, which was called Collins. So that became our first sort of big play into software. What did we learn is it's a complete pivot in the business. So we went from a team which was mainly editorial and customer success to actually getting rid of half of that team and hiring in customer success for software, account management for software, sales for software, and obviously more tech, because we wanted to build everything in-house. So it was a complete pivot in terms of the makeup of the business and the focus of the business. But what was nice for us was it was all a flywheel of itself. So to be on our website, you had to use our software as a restaurant. So the more users we had on our website meant that more pubs wanted to use our software to be on our website. The more pubs, bars and restaurants we had using our software meant the better choice on Design My Night. The more choice, the better SEO, the more users, grow your user base. And it was just a flywheel of itself, basically. So it was a lovely synergy of what we'd already built, fueling the B2B side. And at that same time, we also decided to build a ticketing software. So you have Ticketmaster and Eventbrite and all of those. And the bar partners were listing their events on Design My Night and then linking out to Eventbrite or Ticketmaster or whoever. Again, hundreds of ticket suppliers out there. So we thought, well, we've already got them as customers. Why are we then linking out to these other bits of software? Let's build our own ticketing software. So at exactly the same time as we built the booking software, we also built a ticket software. That whole build was about 8 months to a year. We launched both in, I think, December 2013. So 3 years in was when we launched our software.
Cool. Do you have like a lot of delays in the process? Was it like, yeah, we're coming out like June 2013 and then like, oh, maybe it'll be like August, etc.? Or was it like, yeah, December execution all went perfectly?
It definitely didn't go perfectly, but we gave ourselves a lot of time. So we weren't making any promises to anyone about it, which helps. So we didn't really have any hard deadlines. We put the deadline on ourselves. The reason being, again, because we're just a glutton for punishment, that December's the busiest time for that industry. So we said to a few of our partners who we thank to this day, move over to our booking software in December. If it can stand up your Christmas period, then we're onto something good, even though this is only version one. And the same for ticketing, you've got New Year's Eve. So as a ticketing partner, New Year's Eve is by far and away the busiest couple of nights. So we'd roughly said December to our partners, but hadn't told them to break their contracts with the other suppliers. And fortunately enough, we launched with, yeah, just two people in December just to try it. We probably had about 60 events using our ticketing platform. And yeah, that was how we launched it in December. It had a few glitches, but we were on hand 24 hours a day to make sure anything was fixed. Got through December, and then that set us up nicely to really go for it.
Nice. I guess then what else would also be interesting is like just how you manage that like transition between sort of, did you have to fire people or like reskill people and like finding all the right team members for like technology if you weren't like a technology company? But it seems like there's a lot of stuff you must have had to learn.
Yeah, we did have to let go probably half of our editorial team, which was very tough, but they're the decisions we had to make. We wanted to run a very lean ship. We knew we didn't want to take too much funding. So those are tough decisions you have to make, unfortunately. Another bit of luck for us was Andrew, one of his best friends from home, was a developer at Google, an absolute genius front end, back end. And we'd earmarked him to be our CTO from day one, but he wasn't ready to make the jump early on. So we always said to him, well, when we get our first round of funding, we're going to come and get you, basically. And we used to meet in his Google office for lunch, for free lunches, pretty much 3 days a week, and just get him excited about what we were doing. For someone who loves developing, to actually come and build product and ship product weekly is probably more exciting. So we went and got him, who was our first hire, and we sort of put our faith in him to lead the tech. So Andrew and I were very good product managers. We knew we were very good at taking in the feedback from customers. We had a good vision for the product, both technically and visually. So we just had a very harmonious flow between Will, our CTO, who knew that we weren't technical, who would push us back or say yes, or give us realistic timelines and just manage our expectations. And actually, that's how we ran the whole company eventually, was we put in processes with GitHub that developers could tell the team how much time and effort something would take when the non-technical people or the product people were prioritizing bugs and fixes and improvements and stuff. We could see how much effort it would be for the development team to do. And we had an effort points table. So every week we couldn't give the development team more than 20 effort points. So there's no point me coming along saying, I need this bug fix, and Andrew come along saying, I need this improvement done, and it's 40 points. So actually, I think our first way of working as non-technical founders then influenced the whole company, where we had a pretty harmonious relationship between technical and non-technical.
Yeah, it sounded like it went suspiciously too well almost. This one. Yeah, normally it's a lot more growing pains.
We definitely had growing pains, but we very pragmatic as founders, very realistic. We forecasted very well and very carefully and just took it month by month. We never had this vision of Design My Night being this huge global $1 billion business. We actually knew where we wanted to take it, and actually it didn't need to be that. So I think that affected how we grew the business. It was very carefully done, very pragmatically done. It might have not been like the sexiest startup to like TechCrunch, but that's never what we wanted to achieve. So it has done a lot more carefully, growing the team, growing the culture carefully, making sure everyone was okay. So it was a lot more of us like a supporting environment rather than every week hiring 10 more people. So we could really grow the company organically.
That's nice. I guess like the lessons that you sort of learned growing the team and how you sort of manage the company, if you were doing more of like a slower sort of managed process where you kind of were very much in control, like how did you do that?
It was more that all of our staff knew Andrew and I They knew us personally as people. It was an open plan office. We sat with everyone. We would make time to get to know everyone. And as part of that, they feel comfortable talking to you as a founder. So if they're not happy or if something can be improved, it was always an open door. And that sort of trust between the team and the founders, they knew they weren't going to be castigated for it or black marked. It was a very open approach. A few practical takeaways was every quarter we would do a sort of team all hands, but without Andrew and I there. And that was purely for the team to discuss what they were happy about, what they would like to see improved in the office and the culture. And then one person would feed that back to Andrew and I. We then went back very honestly. So we're like, okay, you want a apple-shaped sofa. Well, we don't think that's a great idea, but you want to do charity days or something. Yeah, that's a great idea. And we would literally go through each of their suggestions, be very honest on why we thought it was a good idea, why it's not. And then we reported back to the team on how we were going with all of those initiatives. So a lot of our great company initiatives actually came from the team. So I'd really recommend people to do that. We did a team lunch once a week. And people could not sit at their desk. If you wanted to sit at your desk and eat team lunch, you didn't get it. And Andrew and I made sure we talk with the team. It wasn't about work. So actually, we're all there just getting to know each other. That was very successful for us. And of course, being a nightlife company, we got invited to lots of parties and stuff. So when you've got a young team, that's a great advantage. And we could all go out, let loose. Again, Andrew and I would be there. We would drink and let loose to a certain extent. But I think it's just your team seeing your human side and actually that we did genuinely care about the team. And then the team will respond in kind.
That's really useful. Like, making a lot of notes of, like, we've just been talking about kind of office policies and how the team's going to work. As we're like, we're probably about to kind of grow a bit. We need to have these things written down somewhere, but there's some good ideas. Super useful. Did you ever make any like mistakes in hiring?
Yeah. So in total, we probably hired about 150 people in our time there. Probably had about 4 or 5 that didn't make probation. So one guy lasted about 4 days and it was more about cultural fit rather than anything. So we really would hire on culture. So for example, some of our best hires were people that were 19, 20, 21 were stocking shelves in Sainsbury's and then actually came to the realization that they wanted to find a career. And customer success, account management are great careers for people where you don't necessarily need experience at the start. So we were just looking for sparky people that could engage with customers, that would be a great fit to the team culture, that really wanted to build a career and grow. We weren't looking for any attitude. We weren't looking for any big I know it alls. Everyone we hired was relatively young or some this was their first job and we wanted to sort of grow them at Design My Night. So we were really meticulous and only until the last couple of years, Andrew and I would sign off every employee that we hired, whether it be early interviews or a final interview. And we often rejected people for company fit, even though we knew they had the skills. Tech's a bit different. Obviously, you need to have the skills. But having said that, one of our best developers, he was developing out of his bedroom for his dad's company, self-taught. He was like 22 when we hired him. Absolute genius and went on to build some of our best tech. So you don't need to hire these people from Harvard that won 150 grand and they're like 23 years old. So it was just this policy of we're all in this together. We're going to muck in together. We're going to have a lot of fun together. And if you've got that mindset and that grit and that culture that Andrew and I had as well, then you'll fit in here and we'll make it work. If you show us that you want to make it work, we'll work hard to grow you at the company too.
Cool. Yeah, that was really interesting. It's certainly hard to, we've done like a cultural and skill fit matrix where we kind of, me and my business partner sat down and basically sort of told each other all the things that we got most annoyed about with each other. And like, we're like, okay, we can't let people do these things. And we have like, got like a sort of scoring thing of trying to find people.
What's the number one?
My one, I think, was like being a bit slow on making decisions and being vague on things. And I think what I was saying about Jack, it was like an hour and a half conversation where like, oh, you're really terrible at this. And like, it was quite nice because we kind of learned a lot in the process. And also just trying to find people that have like some form of like rock star-ish characteristic that isn't maybe not something you'd always look for. But as long as someone has something they're bringing to the table, it's a bit different. It's kind of nice.
I think for us, it was always just that they're going to fit in with everyone else. I think that's the most important part, that we don't want anyone coming with an attitude that they're better than anyone, because they wouldn't last 5 minutes with us, at least.
That's certainly some of the things we've put in there, like the strong opinions is okay, but like weakly held, that kind of thing. And like certainly like listens, and you kind of like, I mean, people say things, but then like I'll sort of have like small little ticks that sort of show that they're not. So like they're like, oh yeah, I'm super relaxed and things, but then on something else they'll like, they'll shut you down so you can't even ask a question. It would be weird if you could answer it, and you're like, are you sure you're relaxed? Because I kind of feel like you're giving me this vibe of something else. And sort of like trying to pick up on the small signs that like don't actually come out in their words, kind of thing, is kind of hard when you've only got like half an hour to interview someone. We just took on like a business partner. That was hard.
It's probably the toughest thing, hiring the right people. I think you learn a knack of just reading people. Luckily, it's a skill I think I've got, is that I think I can read people pretty quickly, and taking into consideration they're in an interview, so they're going to be nervous, etc. But I can just see behind a person, and we're just looking for good, hardworking, friendly people. And actually, if you could tick those boxes, we knew we'd be able to mold you into a good Design My Night employee.
It's a hard one though, because people are kind of different in their interviews, and trying to work out the people who are sort of introverted and shy, but like actually are great. And then the people that are sort of like maybe more extroverted, that maybe you don't want to just hire for people that are good at interviewing, and then there are other qualities you should be looking for. So I guess the main thing to talk about still is then the exit. Did you want to exit, or did someone just approach you? Like, how did the whole process come about, and what were the difficulties?
It was all very planned, as the whole company was. So we, pretty early doors, Andrew and I sat down and discussed what valuation we would want to sell the company for, or would be happy to sell the company for, what sort of minimum base. When we say sell the company for, i.e. ourselves take away from the equity we had, we were pretty much aligned on that number, which was good. We then did research, and when we stumbled upon B2B SaaS, we knew that in hospitality and SaaS, you could get anywhere between like a 10 to 18 times multiple of your EBITDA. So as we were running a very lean company that only took $500,000 angel funding in our whole period, we got to profitability pretty quickly and ran a business at about 48% EBITDA. So we just basically modeled out by, let's say, end of 2016, if we can get to X EBITDA and we find the right buyer, we know we'll be able to sell it for Y. Is that Y enough for us? Yes. Okay, well, let's model the business and let's try and hit those realistic targets to get to that EBITDA figure. And actually, when the investors invested in us, they said, let's try and sell this company within 5 years, which was our plan as well. And we actually sold it like 5 years and like 10 days after they invested. So it was extremely planned. We engaged a broker in end of 2016 to sell the company. And from that engagement, it took about a year. So we sold it in November 2017. From engaging the broker and doing all the process of what an exit entails, it took a year for us to sell the company.
Wow, that's less chaotic than I thought it might be. I was like, normally we had like a acquisition sort of scoping offer whilst on the program, and it's all been a bit like random. I definitely have no idea what I'm doing with the whole process, but that sounds quite organized. So you approached the company that helps you sell the business. So did you have to like sort out loads of documents for them, and then they sort of just went out to different people, kind of then just like pitch them for you, then you sort of just turn up?
So yeah, it's a longer process than that. So we spent probably 4 months with our broker building the IM. So it's called, so your IM is basically your sales deck for an acquisition, which is about 100 slides long, everything to do with your business and where you want the business or where the business can go. So that was probably like 4 months work locked in with our broker. We also did a new financial model with our broker, but for them to be able to build a financial model, it means that they need to really understand the business. So a lot of it was their team and Andrew and I just going, pouring through the business, where we've come from, where we are now, these are all the different revenue lines. Design My Night was actually quite complicated as a business because we had a payment system, we had SaaS, we had the B2C. So we had lots of different sort of revenue streams. So we did that for 4 months. They then sent out what's called a teaser. So like 3 slides without naming the company to people that they think might be interested. So a hospitality software company that's doing this revenue, this EBIT, blah, blah, blah. And then you get a few interested parties. So Andrew and I would then have phone calls with their heads of M&A. And as that started to build up, the broker then goes to market properly. So puts a name on the deck and goes and speaks to a wider group of people that he thinks might buy the company. Loads of no's, not right for us, not the right company, not the right time. We probably ended up talking to about 8 heads of M&A. So that's like a 2-hour chat. Some were transatlantic and Asian. So it was over video call, just going through the business, basically like a long interview about the business. Then about 5 took it to the next level, which was another meeting with the heads of M&A and some other people from their business. And then we got down to offer stage. So 3 put offers on the table of varying degrees of money and earnout periods and how long it would take to close, which was very important. And that's what our broker said to us, is a company might be offering you this, but offering you a 5-month close. And he was like, just be aware that within those 5 months, they can pull the plug at any time. So if a company is offering you a 1-month close versus a 5-month close, but less money, you should still take that into consideration. So with all the factors combined, we chose Access Group, who are a UK software company, £1 billion actually, software company. We liked the terms of the deal. They were going to be a very quick close. They were based just up the road from us. They wanted to keep the company as it was, keep our team. We negotiated the financials 3 or 4 times. And then, yeah, once we agreed a price, it was 2 months due diligence. So that's when you were talking about all the documents. So we had to have a data room and just basically fill that with everything. A lesson for people is to keep their finances in order as you go. So again, our finance manager was very good, very switched on. We had very tidy books. So actually uploading all of our document, you can imagine, needs to go into this data room, from employment contracts, everyone's staff contracts, if you do option pools, all of your finances for the years, your tax returns, everything needs to go into this, your policies, your HR, anything. So that took about 2 months. And then they were obviously checking the data room. Then the call comes to say, yeah, we're good to close. They give you a day. And then you go into a boardroom and spend about 2 hours signing lots of bits of paper. I'm sure that will go online sooner or later. You go to their lawyer's office and yeah, it's just a boardroom filled with documents you need to sign. We pretty much gave most of our staff options as well. So we had to sign on behalf of them. So that's why we had so many documents to sign. So we had like 60 versions of each contract to sign. And then, yeah, the deal was done. And then as of that day, they own you. And then we entered a 2-year earnout period before we then fully exited in Jan this year.
I must have felt great eventually.
It's a really weird feeling. Like it's everything you want. So that's what you aspire to do. Well, most people, when you set up your company, and there's a very weird feeling about achieving your goal. It's a very strange feeling of this is amazing. Obviously, we then had 2 more years, so couldn't get too carried away. Probably hit us more this year was what's next. When you achieve your goal, we're mid-30s. Yes, you can just dive straight back into it again if you want, but it's a weird personal journey on, okay, well, I've achieved this big life goal. What's sort of next for us? And it's a bit of a weird transition period to be in, especially when you obsess over your company for 10 years. It's a strange feeling.
So we can expect to hear some big things maybe next year.
We've launched Horseplay Ventures this year, which is sort of our angel investing arm. As you said, we've invested in 25 companies. So that takes a lot of time. We want to be really hands-on with the companies we invest in. So we're sort of working behind the scenes with a lot of startups and founders. Also, as part of Horseplay, we're looking at a sort of startup studio. Those will be the ideas. So we're sort of coming up with ideas, sort of funding their launch with our cash, and then maybe do a go to market and actually bring in founders to actually run the companies for us. So we're playing with a few ideas at the moment, let's say. So yeah, next year we might launch our first one out of the startup studio, which is exciting.
Cool. That sounds like it's definitely a bit of a dream that I've had with some of my friends for a while, like just sort of being able to have ideas, but not necessarily have to like spend the full 5 years of just running them, but like being able to make them happen and inspire others to do stuff.
I think that's where we want to be right now. I think we're both so knackered from Design My Night. The fun part, let's be honest, is the early years. It's coming up with the idea, iterating on the idea, it's designing it, it's getting excited about it. Once you have a big team and big customers, it then becomes less fun, let's say. So yeah, this idea is a way of us to hopefully come up with some great ideas, know how to validate ideas now, have confidence that an idea is good. We're under no pressure, so we can launch good things. They don't all have to be rock stars. So we can launch smaller ones, bigger ones, ones that might be huge, have some fun in the process. That's why we called it Horseplay Ventures. Have a bit of fun horsing around. I think everyone takes the startup world a bit seriously now. I think that's what it should be. That's why you've left. That's why you're not doing a conventional job, is to have some freedom and have some fun. So we're sort of trying to embody that ourselves as well.
Yeah, that's really cool. Because it's certainly like a mentality, as we've been saying, is it's a bit more like the, you must have like a $1 billion idea and you must raise lots of money as quickly as possible, which is kind of cool if you do want to change the world. But sometimes you want to just have things that are fun to do. And yeah, your whole mental health is a thing.
Yeah, I mean, mental health is huge now, and so it should be. But also, I think we live in this era with like TechCrunch and all of that, where you only hear about these huge $1 billion companies. But actually, the lifeblood of, let's say, the British economy is startups, ones that you won't see on TechCrunch, whether it be someone that employs 3 people or like us, 70, 80 people, or ones that employ thousands of people. Not every startup has to be, let's call it, a TechCrunch startup. You can actually change the lives of a lot of your employees, give them careers. And as founders, like Andrew and I, hit our wildest dreams financially and then go on to do other stuff. You don't have to sell a company for hundreds and hundreds of millions of pounds for it to be deemed a success. And I think it's an unrealistic start to any startup if that is all you're aiming for, is VC millions and then a $1 billion exit, because most people won't achieve that. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, as in the likelihoods of success are just so much lower. And certainly, I mean, like the worst field, I'm kind of in like the social media space with my current startup, which is sort of the normal failure rates are like 9 and 10. So probably it'll end up being some form of pivot into like B2B or something. But for now, I've got the $1 billion dream and I'm chasing it. So that's fine. But yeah,
exactly.
But it is a bit of a funny one. Okay, cool. So first round of question is, what's one of your earliest ever memories?
God, that is a question. I always discuss this, not this question, that I can never like remember much childhood. And I was very lucky to have a good childhood. I think one of my earliest memories is going to Spain on a family holiday. And it's actually a very embarrassing story, but I was very young. We were down by the pool and I needed the toilet. And I said to my dad, I need the toilet. And it was a long way back to the room. And we were like sprinting back to the room. And when we got into the room, I relieved myself in the bedroom, not the bathroom. So I remember the exact hotel, and it was in Mallorca actually. And I can even visualize in my head the journey from the swimming pool back to the bedroom. I can walk you through that hotel now. I was young, to be fair. I wasn't 20.
I remember like one time in class, I was like sort of a 6-year-old or something, and when you sort of have got out of the weeing of phase, you think, and then like being in class and then sort of being like, crap, I really need the toilet. And so the teacher wouldn't listen to me. I had my hand up, like, trying to go. And then she finally sort of gets me like, miss, I need to get the, it's too late now. I just sat there like, crap. Yeah, it wasn't good. Sad times. Okay. And then the other question is, what's one of the kindest things someone has done for you?
Well, I think for us in our business world was actually, so I mentioned our mentor who became our first investor, John, who's the head of entrepreneurship at London Business School. Andrew actually met him at a friend of a friend's dinner, and John was the dad of this friend. And Andrew was in the kitchen and John walked in and started talking to Andrew, and Andrew was telling him about Design My Night, and this was the early doors. And just from that chat, he said, come and see me every month at the London Business School. And this was the head of entrepreneurship and a professor there. I want to mentor you guys. Out of nothing, had nothing in it. He just really liked chatting to Andrew And we went and saw him literally every month or every 2 months. And he gave us like an hour of his time for nothing. And we just learned so much from him on that journey. He became our chairman and we'll forever be indebted to him to take us under his wing for no gain. And then also he was a cracking chairman as well. So just that pure selflessness to offer advice and knowledge was beautiful. And that's something that we want to do now, which is part of Horseplay, is to help startups and founders as well, because we just really believe in the ecosystems. We want to help it where we can.
Cool. Yeah, it's really great to hear that you sort of got so much out of like the angels, and have now you literally just gone straight into a thing that sort of helped you so much. So big kudos on that. And thanks a lot for the podcast and all your advice that you've shared today.
Thank you very much. Thoroughly enjoyed it. Cheers, Sam.
Sure. So just to find you, it's like horseplayventures.vc.
Horseplay.ventures.
Horseplay.ventures, and Pitch Deck is the podcast. Great.
Yeah. Find me on LinkedIn. It's the best place to try and find me personally.
Yeah, me too lately. I just had to delete all my other social media. It's just like,
yeah, I don't use any other social actually. The only social media I've got is not even a proper social media. I keep the private life to my private and then just do LinkedIn basically.
That's good. Well, who knows? Maybe you'll start using Syncify and you'll have a slightly
That'll be my second one.
Yeah. Cool.
Properly.
Thanks for listening to the show. If you have any questions, please reach out to me through the website at growthmindsetpodcast.com. I do love talking to listeners. You can support us on Patreon or by leaving a review on iTunes or telling a friend about us. But mostly, keep learning and keep growing.